Welcome to 5 Lives to 50, the sustainability podcast for product managers. I am Shelley Metcalf, and I'm here with my two co-hosts, Jim Fava and Neil D'Souza. And joining us today is Connie Hensler to talk about product sustainability at Interface Inc., where she works as Global Director of Environmental Management and Product Stewardship. Connie is also the current chair of the American Center for Lifecycle Assessment. Welcome, Connie. It's great to have you with us.
Thanks, Shelley. I'm so pleased to be here. It's a real honor.
We're honored to have you join us too. And for the sake of our listeners who may not know much about Interface, I'd like to start by asking you to describe a little bit what Interface manufactures and its history with sustainability, because it's got a bit of a unique history.
Yeah, sure. Interface is a global flooring manufacturer. We make modular flooring, like carpet tiles, resilient and rubber flooring. And we're a mid-sized company with annual sales of just over $1 billion. And we're headquartered in Atlanta, Georgia, but we have manufacturing sites in many countries across Europe and the Asia-Pacific region. But we aren't really known for our flooring as much as we are known for our design and sustainability leadership. You know, we're more of a sustainability company who happens to make flooring. That's the perception of us in the marketplace, I think.
But you do it well, that's cool. And that's the point at the end, right?
Yeah, we're lucky to be put on a mission many years ago, back in 1994, when our founder, Ray Anderson, had his environmental epiphany about the damage that the company does to the environment. And he really turned the entire company's mission towards eliminating that environmental impact. Of course, we still have to make flooring and we have to make money to support that sustainability habit. But that's really where all of our focus is and has been since 1994.
Connie, do you remember how big of a company you were back in 1994?
I don't remember the exact figure. We were certainly a lot smaller than we are today. We have acquired a lot of companies and we have had organic growth. Back in 94, carpet tile was our only flooring. We didn't have the other businesses. And carpet tile was really just in its infancy. Most carpet wasn't modular back then. It was broadloom. And so it's been a real revolution in the flooring industry to move from, you know, giant rolls of flooring down to the modular concept, which is so much more sustainable. But yeah, so we've grown a lot since 1994.
The reason I ask is when you're a tiny company doing something that isn't, I would say, I mean, flooring has been around for a long time. I mean, the kind of flooring has changed. And as you described, you know, the products have evolved over time. But it's not nuclear fusion. It is not artificial intelligence. You know, these kind of hit themes that everybody focuses on. It's quite unique to find something that makes you stand out. It's not often that a company finds it. It seems you guys banked on being the most sustainable company of your kind. Would that be fair to say?
Oh, yeah, definitely. We just did it so early in the game before anybody else was doing it. I think that's what really made us stand out.
So how did you start?
That was so long ago. You know, we really began with Mission Zero, our goal to eliminate all of our environmental impact. And it wasn't just a top-down initiative. Obviously, it was driven by the chairman, CEO of the company, which is immeasurable in the impact that can provide. But it was also a groundswell on the factory floor because we engaged all employees in it. Because let's face it, anybody who's in the company who's doing anything, whether you're answering the phone or you're running a tufting machine, you are contributing to the environmental impact. So everybody's contributing. So how can everybody contribute to reducing or eliminating that impact? And instead of coming to work to help the company make money, you know, take home your paycheck, you were coming to work to save the world. Everybody was inspired. And you got such great employee energy in that.
Yeah, a lot of the interaction we've had with companies in the past, they're top down, even the employees are all 100% behind it. But there's often like a middle manager that begins to stand in the way. Did you had the same belief and action by the middle managers as you did from the top down in the factory floor?
Yeah, probably the middle management is always the last to adopt to the change. But having that drive from the top, so it became every manager's part of their KPIs and they get on board or get off the train approach really helped. And, you know, they tied all the performance to it. And they tied bonus schedules to it. And if you wanted to earn your bonus, you better be meeting your environmental targets. So that helped a lot too.
Connie, sustainability has been around for a while. I think the good part of about 40 years. But when I talk to product managers, when I talk to engineers, many of them do not know what it is. And I can imagine as you go, and these are highly educated people that are focusing on creating products that are typically very technical. You do this typically for complicated products that require prioritization, that require trade-off analysis and stuff like that. So forget about the people who are more on the shop floor. How did you end up translating the ambitions of being more sustainable to what the entry level or the shop floor employees had to do on a daily basis?
Yeah, you know, it's all about the metrics. You had to be measuring something. It had to be measurable. And then you had to be able to score against the goal. So We got down way deep in the details of, there were spreadsheets and spreadsheets of all the different parts of the business that we were measuring, all the different pieces, from scrap rates on every single machine. How are we going to reduce this waste? Because, you know, a huge part of our impact is always waste and efficiencies. So everybody had a scorecard. There were posters in the plant, daily updated with progress. You know, you'd see that a lot, maybe in quality. Maybe you see those kind of charts and graphs posted about daily quality accomplishments. But ours were, in addition, we had quality too as well. But ours were tied to what are the environmental goals. And the metrics were so fine that you could see, right, not daily, it was probably weekly performance.
If I'm reading it correctly, you translated or someone translated, hey, you know, we want to reduce waste. This is something easy. I would say if you want to reduce carbon impact, this becomes a little more complicated, right? Because the steps to translating that to the shop floor saying, okay, we need to make sure you have less trim, right? Less amount of waste that you throw away. And how much does that translate to the carbon impact? I think waste, if you just had a waste impact and you said, reduce the weight of the bag of scrap at the end of the day, this is much easier. So how low did you have to go to operationalize this?
Yeah, you know, when we started, we weren't doing life cycle assessment. We just had a list of things that we knew we needed to reduce. Non-renewable energy, virgin raw materials, waste factors. You know, we just had this long list of things we thought were relevant to environmental impact. But then in 2000, we adopted the use of life cycle assessment for our metric. And of course, we weren't just focused on carbon for many years. We were focused on all the different impact categories. But then eventually, 10 years in, we started looking more narrowly, focusing on carbon. So anyway, with life cycle assessment, because we do life cycle assessment on all the thousands of products that we make, you can drill down to the shop floor and say, if you decrease the trim waste by this much, it reduces the carbon footprint by this much. We had to be using life cycle assessment before we were able to do that. Before that, you could only tie it to really cost because financial accounting was all we had at the time.
Was there any epiphany that came out of using life cycle assessments that you did not have before?
Oh, yeah. I tell you, because when we started and we were just a carpet company, the chemistry and the formulation work that we did internally was really focused on the backing, which is the mass of the carpet. For modular carpet, it has a real structured back for dimensional stability and insulation and all. And that's where our expertise was. We were good at that. We understood that very well. So we just kind of assumed that's what we should be working on. But we did life cycle assessment, and suddenly we realized, oh my gosh, that's one of the least impactful parts of our product. Really, the nylon yarn on the top, the energy inputs, and the waste factors were really driving. So yeah, it was very helpful. Unfortunately, it showed us that we had to work on stuff that we didn't have as much control over. But it's what we needed to be working on.
Awesome.
There's this other aspect of Mission Zero that I think would be really interesting to look at. And I've heard you mention before that traditional solutions tend to be incremental. And Interface didn't do that. Instead, it set a target to eliminate its environmental impact and called that Mission Zero. How did not choosing an incremental target change the problem you were trying to solve?
Traditional product development tends to be improve a product characteristic or maybe add a feature. And you just kind of assume that there's an added goal of improved sustainability. And that leads to, or maybe there is a specific improvement dictated by the product brief. And that usually leads to incremental changes and incremental improvements. It's just the normal way of doing product development. But when the product development goal is to have zero negative environmental impact, you kind of have to rethink the whole plan. I mean, you can approach it incrementally if you have decades to achieve it, but changing your mindset from incremental to reaching zero makes you look at the larger system. Can it breaks you out of your thought pattern that product development usually works in? The seemingly impossibility of zero, you know, kind of shakes you out of the normal ways of approaching a project and makes you see things in a new way. You're forced to find new ways to look at the problem.
When you think about the define, you know, net positive kind of thing, how do you look at 10 years down the road and the carpet being replaced or remodeled or things like that? Do you establish partners that will come in and do the recovery, reuse, or do you do that yourself? How do you handle the end of life in the design portion of your project?
Yeah, it is a huge challenge. And we have been recycling carpet internally ourselves, bringing it back from the customer since 2000. Well, no, we started in like 98, but I think probably wasn't really robust until 2000. And that's one way to approach it. And so what we had to do was we had to set up reverse logistics to get the stuff back from our customers, then to develop processes to grind it up and separate it and put it back into carpet tile. And that's been our model for recycling all these years. But I will say it's a real struggle because oftentimes the person we sell the carpet to doesn't own the carpet when it's time for it to come back. We've tried a lot of different models. We've tried what we call an evergreen lease, where we like lease the carpet so that we can maintain ownership of it. It's very challenging to make the finances of that work, but we're able to do it a little bit. But the vast majority of what we do bring back millions of pounds each year of carpet. In retrospect, 25 years on, even though we bring back millions of pounds, it's still a very small amount of what we actually sell. So in retrospect, I think it's more important to not focus on that closed loop recycling carpet to carpet, but to find partners and look at the broader technical cycle of things being recycled. We also do have reuse partners that we have where we bring back carpet that's still ready to have another life. It doesn't need to be recycled. And so we work with these partners, and what they do is they refurbish, clean, process, repackage, and then send it on for another life. And we're going to be expanding on that in the coming years because it's such a missed opportunity. Why grind the stuff up and remake it if it's perfectly fine? We make carpet for commercial interiors, not residential. And so it's really high performance. And it's a little over-engineered sometimes, I think, because it lasts longer than our customers use it. So I think it's a missed opportunity if we're not moving it into the reuse market.
Well, it's like clothes, you know, clothes you wear a couple of times. But carpet, yeah. I've had blue for 5 years. Now I want a green or something. And
right.
So the flooring is fine.
Yeah. Oftentimes we find that the lease cycle on commercial office space is usually about 7 years. And when the lease changes, man, they change the carpet, need it or not. Or time for, like you say, a new color, a new design. A lot of carpet doesn't see its full use potential.
With all the Green Building Council and LEED initiative that's been around for decades, is LEED still a major player in your market? Or
just to open up that question a bit more, right? What is driving consumers or your customers to buy your product as opposed to anyone else?
LEED was very useful. It's still in place. It drives a lot of the second comers to take sustainability initiatives and to meet the minimums. It certainly
what do you
doesn't
mean by
drive.
Second comers?
I just made that word up. So I don't have a good definition, but I'm talking about the followers. They are just attempting to meet the market requirements.
Yep.
Now the market does have some requirements for sustainability, at least in the built environment. If you're going to play, you've got to at least meet certain LEED criteria. And so those businesses meet those requirements to do business, not as a leadership position. Where was I? Oh, yeah. We were going to talk about what's driving
purchases. Why do people still love your product as opposed to anyone else?
We're focused on what the customer is asking for in performance. Mm-hmm. We're telling them what they need from the sustainability side.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that sounds really arrogant, doesn't it? We spend a lot of time on education, trying to explain, you know, what the problem is and what the solutions are. And we try to encourage our customers to want the environmental attributes that we have.
But would they need to pay more for it, Connie? How do they react to that?
So I think it's a misperception. People assume that if it's more environmentally friendly, that it costs more money. And that is a construct of the people who are developing products they're saying, oh, well, the customer is going to pay more for this because they want it. So I got 10%, I've got 25% more money to spend developing this product. And that's just so wrong thinking. If you're reducing the environmental impact, you're probably improving efficiency and reducing waste and the things that drive down cost. Now, if you gave me 25%, okay, your product development, we're going to make a new product. You get to spend 25% more. Well, I'll spend it. You can bet. But if you look at it differently, don't make that part of the product brief. You're throwing that money away. Cost parity is job number one at Interface. I mean, Ray Anderson, our founder, you got to make it more sustainable. It's got to perform the same. It has to cost the same. And if you would bring it to him and it costs more, he would say, go back to the drawing board. You have to widen your perception of how to get there. It's kind of like putting the zero target on there, putting the cost parity target on there really changes your development process.
Connie, from you've been doing this for a very long time, but does that restrict the jumps you can make? Typically, when you look at efficiency as the prime driver of reducing impact, you make 10%, 20%, 30% improvements, and you do this iteratively, but at some point, there's a law of diminishing returns. And then you need to change the game once again, which takes investment sometimes. Think of the investments that you make in thinking about how to use recycled materials in your product, or setting up these relationships for reuse so that the entire portfolio reduces its environmental impact. The question is just, do you think product managers should consider or leave their options open to potentially having a more costly product, but with a dramatically different outcome? Or do you think that it doesn't need to be that way at all?
I think it can be both, yeah. But I think it should start with cost parity and, you know, see what you can do. Like, we had to build an entire new backing line and processing line to make our carbon negative products and to make our recycled back products. And the cost of the product, you know, the raw material cost and the processing cost needed to, you know, all that investment was based on, we're going to make the product cost the same. But of course, there is capital investment and that part of the finance layer. Yeah.
Is that something that you could use? So in Europe, for example, there is tremendous amounts of money for those kind of capital investments, things that can significantly alter the outcome of the impact of the product. There's even loans that one can get now, which are ESG-based loans that have better interest rates to fund exactly these kind of initiatives. Were these helpful to you as a company? Is this something that other product managers should look into as something relevant? Or do you think this wasn't necessary for your growth path?
You know, it hasn't been necessary for Interface, but yes, if anybody has the opportunity to take advantage of it, absolutely. We do partner with, like, for instance, we're partnering on a recycling initiative in Europe for flooring with all the other flooring manufacturers, and it's being funded. So we're looking to get help and participate and use that funding to get recycling for all the flooring industry, not just particularly for Interface. We haven't taken advantage of that as a single company in the past. But yes, it's a great opportunity for a lot of companies, I think.
Right. So 10 years ago, this was not a thing. But I think now there's several companies that have looked at this as an opportunity to invest in that next generation of products and processes to make products that we're currently using.
Yeah, it's definitely facilitating much more rapid product development, I think.
Speaking of this, at the end of the day, a lot of this is, do we have the means to get to the outcome we're looking to do? Firstly, okay, getting to the outcome, and we already talked about this, the zero goal, right? The getting to zero is one of those, mission zero, as you called it, that's the goal that you set. And the parameters that you set were cost parity, performance parity, and then reduced impact. You mentioned that there was compensation plans that were tied to this. Was there anything else that the company needed to start? The place that I come from is for product managers where this is new. And there are still tons of them where this hasn't been implemented more than, I'd say, experiments, right? You do a bit of investigation to know what your hotspots are. I think there's lots of companies, or let's put it differently, there's very few $500 million companies and up that have never investigated this. I think there's a large portion of $100 million to $5 billion revenue companies that have done something in this space. But for those that have not done anything significant in terms of investigating what the opportunities are and whether it makes business sense, try to figure out how to get them to take that first step.
Yeah. There's so much low-hanging fruit with those guys. You've got to set a measurable target. I think that's the only way to get started. You can't just have this, oh, the marketing team wants to have a sustainability story, come up with something. And I think lifecycle assessment, it so clearly identifies what those, you know, one, two, three things are that you need to do. And you can clearly measure whether you're doing it or not. So I think it's a great place to start. What are your hotspots? And then list the projects you can do to address them and then measure your progress using lifecycle assessment. Of course, I'm an LCA practitioner and that's my, you know, if the only tool you have is a hammer, every problem is a nail. Well, for me, every problem, it can be solved with lifecycle assessment. So take it with a grain of salt there.
When you go back through a corporate goal of a net zero and that transferred down to actually individual products, so every product manager in the design has a goal that they can contribute and link back to that overall net zero. Could you talk a little bit about how that happens?
Yeah, today, you know, our goal is on specific quantified reductions in science-based targets initiative on carbon emissions reduction, scope 3 emissions reductions. So we do the lifecycle assessment on every product made every year, which is thousands of products. And we create what is the global product carbon footprint.
Uh-huh.
And
based on that lifecycle work?
Yes. Yeah, our targets are on cradle to gate, obviously. We're measuring and recording, but we're not targeting reductions in the rest of the lifecycle, just cradle to gate. So we know in each region how their products contribute to that total. And then at that region, we know which products contribute what. Sometimes it's that they're selling products with a higher impact in one region than more of them in one region than the other, because the market demand for that product style is higher in one place than another. Anyway, it's really granular. It goes all the way down to what's the product portfolio that you're selling.
Sure.
And also, because you can make a great sustainable product with really low environmental impact, but if you don't sell very much of it, it's not really driving your global
number.
So, and sometimes that's the first step. And then you got to figure out how to sell more of it. But better if the big ticket, the big products where you sell a lot, if you can reduce the impact on them, then it changes your global number. So yeah, we're just trying to drive that global carbon footprint down to meet a 2030 goal and then a 2040 goal. And so every product's contribution in every region and every factory shows how they know how they roll up into that number.
This is very interesting. Typically, when I talk to product managers, they will look at a product that is not a Bestandsprodukt, as you say is in German, right? Which is not one of my big cash cows. I look at something on the side. If I change it and something goes wrong, it doesn't affect the business a lot. Don't change something that's working. But what you just said is fundamentally opposite. And it's true, right? If you work with a product and create even a perfect innovation and take it to zero, it's not just about not selling a lot of that product, but it may not have an impact because it was never a big portion of your business anyways to begin with. Was there a mind shift that needed to happen for you to start considering the big chunks? Because that's a huge risk to affect products that are currently your biggest sellers and probably the most profitable products that you have.
It was a mindset and it was set by management. I remember the president of Interface Americas sales organization. And he said, we will not introduce hero products, product that's super sustainable. It makes a great story and it's great marketing, but it's not something that's core to the business. And our competitors are always throwing up a hero product. Look at this. And I'm like, yeah, but how much of that are you selling? It was a real decision internally because our mission was to reduce our footprint, not to gain market notoriety. You know, we were looking to actually reduce our footprint. So don't make a hero product. If you're going to make an improvement, make it on the core materials that we sell a lot of.
I'm going to steal this from you, hero product. This is cool.
We've been working with companies about doing portfolio assessments. And you mentioned the portfolio a minute ago. Do you have like a portfolio assessment approach where you, I know BSF and Chemours and others have got sort of a good, bad, and ugly kind of ones. And the ones that are not so good, they figure out a way to fix or remove from the business. The ones that are the accelerators or the ones that have both sustainability and business value. Does the Interface have something like that? Or is it more on a product, this product or product?
You know, it's not really based on individual products. And we don't rank them. I've seen those things. It's a great one. I think it's BASF that does one. Right. And we don't really take that approach because we're just looking at all the raw materials we buy. Okay. These millions of tons of stuff. This stuff, it's a certain percent fossil-based polymers and mined minerals, right? The goal is all of that stuff needs to be 100% recycled or bio-based. So go. How can you change all of those things to something recycled or bio-based? And it's not really on an individual product. It's on the whole tons of stuff we buy.
Okay, I got you.
Yeah. We don't have a goal to say, you know, these are the highest impact products, stop selling them, reformulate them.
Every company has got their own business model and the way they run the business. So portfolio assessment works for some, but you know,
right, absolutely. Especially if you have really different products, because fluorine is fluorine. They're pretty similar from one square meter to the next. But if I was in the chemicals business, wow, it's really different products making up their portfolio.
Well, it's sort of interesting. When I first met Ray Anderson, I participated in the President's Council for Sustainable Development back in the early 90s. And Ray Anderson was there and Sam Johnson with S.C. Johnson. And it was like, holy mackerel, those major players in the whole sustainability market and you know what they've done. And to see Interfaith from that early 90s continuing through multiple leaders and multiple management structures and still have that same vision that Ray put in place in the early 90s. I mean, it's really a testimony to Interfaith and what you all have done, and yet you're still doing it. That's wonderful.
Yeah, you know, when Ray passed away several years ago, we were all in a bit of a panic. Oh my God, are we going to stay on our mission? And we've been through a couple of CEOs since then. And fortunately, it's just so core that this freight train, it's running down the track, fortunately. And you know, it's successful too. If we weren't successful financially, certainly we wouldn't keep doing it. So that doesn't just feel good. It actually is good.
Yeah, that's a great story. I mean, you've shared some great learnings, I think, for our listeners to hear about Interfaith's success in building sustainability into core products, the not to be afraid of picking a really ambitious goal like Mission Zero and to measure it, and also to not be afraid of setting your own constraints to achieve those things. I mean, you've really showed how some of those ideas have not only moved your company towards sustainability, but you've been successful too. Connie, I'd love to just end with a final thought from you for our listeners, something that you might like them to think about and take away from today.
Oh, sure. Well, I hesitate to preach because product development at Interfaith is pretty unique because it's a really unique company. And sustainability aspects are always the main driver in our product development. Our challenges tend to be more technical than they are political or logistical. It's always how do we reduce the footprint while also meeting cost and performance requirements. But I guess I would say put the restriction of cost parity on every project. Say, improve sustainability profile of the product without increasing the cost. And they'll say you're crazy and that's not possible. But that's really where the magic begins. That's where you come up with different ideas. And also, I would say don't settle for incremental improvements. Make the target a moonshot. In regards to climate change, we don't really have time for incremental change. We have to make real progress and we have to make it quickly. And I think much of that responsibility lies with you, with the product development people. So I hate to put the burden on you, but it's important. It needs to be done. So get it done.
Connie, well said. And thank you very much. We really enjoyed the conversation and the excellent input. And I'm sure a lot of people will walk away with some very actionable items.
And that concludes this episode and our interview with Connie Hensler. If you enjoyed this episode and would like to get in touch with us, you can find Neil, Jim, or I on LinkedIn and join us on a conversation there. And next episode, we continue our series of interviews with thought leaders in product sustainability, and we'll see you then.